From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 1985 when the grandson of Oscar Mayer made a life-changing decision. And yes, it's the Oscar Mayer you know so well, so it's no surprise that future generations in that family were well cared for. Chuck Collins was 26 years old then, and his family had set him up with $500,000. Chuck was, as he says now, part of the 1% of America. But something felt off about the whole arrangement. Why should he have such a cushion when others had to struggle for every last cent? He hadn't really earned it. It didn't really feel fair. So at the age of 26, he told his family he was going to give away that $500,000. He thought his life would be more rewarding and more fair. And several decades later, Chuck Collins is one of the leading voices for a truly egalitarian American society. He's been a prominent voice calling for fair taxation and greater opportunity for everyone. He co-authored a book with Bill Gates Sr. about the value of the estate tax and why the wealthiest Americans should be eager to give back to more than just pet causes. And his new book is called Born on Third Base, A One Percenter Makes the Case for Tackling Inequality, Bringing Wealth Home, and Committing to the Common Good. Today, Chuck is giving a presentation at RIT about that subject. You can check it out and meet him there. They'll have copies of the book as well for sale at RIT, 4 to 5 o'clock at the Golisano Auditorium in Golisano Hall, if you want to check that out. The book, by the way, is a plea to the wealthiest Americans to get more in the game, to value equal opportunity, but it's also a call to the 99% to stop just demonizing the wealthy and start trying to enlist more 1%ers in various causes. So we're going to find out how he does that. Chuck Collins, welcome to Connections. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Evan.
Well, I know you've told the story a lot, but and I'm sorry to make you do it again, but for most of our listeners, it'll be a new story. So you're 26 years old, and I want to know, when did you know you wanted to give away your $500,000 inheritance?
It may have started actually when I was seven, because I grew up in Detroit in a very, very wealthy suburb, and I could see the gap between where I lived and Detroit. But in my mid-20s, I actually had a job working with tenants in mobile home parks, and I was helping them. My job was to help them figure out how to buy their parks and own their mobile home parks. And actually, I got to work in upstate New York and other places as well. But what that gave me was this like intimate front row seat into low-income people's economic circumstances, just as wages were starting to stagnate in the 80s. And so I saw how people were taking on more work and working more hours and taking on debt just to survive. And coming from a wealthy family, I had this intimate front row seat in how wealth was starting to create more wealth. And that was really a key moment for me, was like, wow, I'm not sure I want to be part of this system that is compounding wealth and advantage for people like me. So that was really kind of the moment when I think I thought, you know, I think I'm going to move the gift along and try to make my own way.
And, you know, you write about how so many people in the wealthiest brackets in this country, and often their descendants, their kids, kind of, and I don't mean this in a way that is sneering, it's just an observation, and I think that's what you do in the book pretty well, is you say there's a lot of discussion that, well, we made the right decisions, and if the other people who are poorer or not as wealthy or don't have the same means just made better decisions, because it's a way of convincing yourself we've earned it. And of course we have this much money. We've earned it. Something in your life was different. I mean, was it the way you were raised? Was there an experience? Or was it, as you say, that work that you were doing in your mid-20s when you kind of got to see it up close, the way people struggled, the pride they had in community? How do you think it was that kind of shaped you?
Well, I think that whatever the mythology of deservedness just didn't stick for me. I mean, first of all, I was literally born on third base. I mean, I can only claim that I picked the right parents in that case. You know, I picked wealthy parents. Otherwise, it was just clear I won the lottery. And there was a story in our family about how the family had, you know, been a successful family over four generations, but I had no part in that. And I was meeting people who were working extremely hard. So the story just didn't work for me. The kind of I couldn't adopt I somehow have a claim on this wealth. It just didn't stick.
And you didn't want to give away half? You know, I mean, like, you're going to give away the whole thing.
Well, you know, as a parent with children in their 20s now, you sort of understand that the world is more black and white sometimes. And anyway, it seemed for me, it was a deep desire to kind of make it on my own without something that happened in the past. Now, the moment I gave that wealth away, I actually thought I was taking this enormous leap. here's the reality, Evan, is I have a mountain of other advantages that are kind of almost hardwired into my life. I mean, four generations of economic stability in a family, social networks, access to health care. I'm white, I'm male. I mean, I have this enormous wind at my back that is just kind of wired into my life.
Even without $500,000 in the
bank. Yeah, so I didn't really fully understand. I mean, I don't have to worry about my parents, you know.
And by the way, what did your dad say about this?
Well, you know, I wrote my parents a letter when I had made this decision to pass this money along, and they, you know, they were understandably concerned, as any parent would be. But my dad said, you know, listen, have you thought this through? You're young, you're in your 20s. What if you someday have a child and that child has a special need? Or what if you have a partner, a spouse, and that person gets ill? Wouldn't you wish you had that cushion of money? And my response was, well, then I would be in the same boat as 99% of all the people I know. I would have to get help. To which he said, well, you would ultimately have to fall back on government, and that's a lousy safety net. To which I said, well, wouldn't I have a stake in maybe making that a better safety net? To which he said, oi, you're so idealistic, you know? But, it comes back to you now that I have children in my own 20s and I see their own idealism and how it spurs me on, you know?
But I mean, like, what if your house burned down?
Well, in this case, so that is actually part of the story, which is, I did give the money away, and it was really a couple months later that the house burned down that I was living in, and no one was hurt, but I lost everything I owned. And if you've ever had that experience, it's very disorienting. You know, where am I going to go, and what am I going to do next? And a very powerful moment was the day after this fire, where I'm just sort of standing there with one of my housemates, looking at the rubble. Up pull the four cars, and they're all leaders from one of the mobile home parks locally that I had helped, and had shown me a lot about what it was like to stand up for each other. And they came to literally help us put our lives back together, you know, brought the casseroles and the shovels and the trash bags, and they put in a day of work. And that was a moment, kind of a spiritual moment for me, where I sort of felt like, yeah, I want to live in a world where I want to be in a community where people are all in for each other. And I actually believe that the money was somewhat of a barrier for me to making those connections. And so it was kind of a cosmic moment of like, yeah, this is the world I want to live in.
Remarkable. I see the phone ringing already. If you want to call the program as we talk to Chuck Collins about his book, Born on Third Base, a one percenter makes the case for tackling inequality, bringing wealth home, and committing to the common good, you can call us at 844-295-TALK. That's toll free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're calling from Rochester, 263-9994. Chuck is giving a presentation on his book at RIT this afternoon, 4 to 5 o'clock in the Golisano Auditorium at Golisano Hall. The book is one of, you've got several books under your belt, and you've been working on these various issues, writing articles, making presentations. Why this book? Why now, Chuck?
Well, I think that, the other books that I've written are pretty fact-heavy, talking about how these inequalities are affecting us. One of the things I've learned is, you know, facts don't always change how people think about things. And in fact, some of the powerful stories of people that I've met, wealthy individuals, others, actually I want people to know. And part of the urgency right now of writing Born on Third Base was I wanted to talk to everybody, but I also wanted to talk to the wealthiest 1% and say, look at the circumstances we're living in. These extreme inequalities are actually undermining the quality of life for everybody, including wealthy people. That where we're going, the trajectory of these inequalities is going to destabilize the economy. It's going to break apart civic and social cohesion. It affects our politics. You know, a polarized economy gives rise to a polarized politics, and that's what we're living through. So part of my motivation for writing Born on Third Base was to say to the wealthy, you know, it's time to wake up and come home. You know, like, stop wandering the globe. You know, bring your wealth home, put it back into communities. Be part of fixing these inequalities, because they're actually, it's in your self-interest not to allow this to get worse.
This book tackles that kind of subject in a lot of different ways. And before we get to a little bit more here, I want to grab our first phone call, because Ron in Rochester, well, Ron, if I have it right, you believe you're at a disadvantage for being a white male. Is that right?
Absolutely. I think times change. I mean, first of all, I am absolutely not in any way, shape, or form racist or prejudiced towards anybody. In any way, shape, or form, I've got friends of every nationality, male, female, you name it. But the key, I think, here is that I've come into situations where it's been tough on me to land something with a good background. I've never done anything wrong in any way, shape, or form. I've good character, pretty well known in the environment in the area here in the county, doing the things that I do on a different basis. But when my father grew up, just think about it, at Xerox 25, 30 years ago, when things were prospering a little bit, and he didn't have to then battle all of these fabulous women now that have taken all of these jobs and stepped into unbelievably great roles. The amount of technology coming from all those individuals from India and all these other countries that have infiltrated into the United States now. And I've got friends in law enforcement that scored 98, 95, 99, 100 on those entrance exams, and they're passed over for females and other minorities that have scored 80, 85% on those exams. And let me tell you what, it is not an advantage today. I'll guarantee you that compared to what it was 25 years ago.
All right, so stay on the line, Ron. I appreciate the call. Chuck, go ahead.
Well, I hear what you're saying. One thing, Ron, when I think about the last 40 years is, you know, these inequalities, the real wages for the bottom half of the society has pretty much stayed stagnant or fallen.
Yeah.
And that's why I think there's some of the anger and resentment. And it's not just among, you know, white working class. I mean, it's something that affects people of color who are also being sort of left behind. But even prior to that, there are these deeper historical inequalities, whether it's women being excluded from the workforce or the long-term legacy of racism and wealth building and that sort of thing. So we're trying to fix a lot of things. We're trying to, and I guess I would want to live in a society where we have women in the workforce who choose to be there, where men like you and I may actually not necessarily always have to be in the breadwinner role, where we have more choices and opportunities. The problem is these inequalities that we're living through kind of supercharge all the tensions and divisions between us. And
absolutely,
that's the thing I think, you know, if we were in Canada or Northern Europe and Denmark, you and I probably, you know, the people you're talking about who feel like they're being passed over wouldn't feel that brunt of economic insecurity that we feel here in the United States. So I would just say, let's try to get at the underlying problem here, which is these, how we're pulling apart as a society and pitting ourselves against each other, men versus women, white people versus people of color, actually doesn't help us move forward.
Yeah, not at all. And it's the character of the type of person and the individual, I think, that thinks that way. But if you really reflect back, there had to be a trigger, and that trigger is rather recent, of what got us back here almost regressing instead of making progress forward. And that's an interesting topic in itself.
But Ron, can I ask you a question?
Yes, sir.
Because, I mean, I got to say, I have one problem with the premise is that, you know, you as a white male feel at a disadvantage because you could get 98 or 99 an exam, but you're not getting the job to women and people of color who are scoring 80 or 85, which implies that women and people of color are not also scoring at a high level, which they almost certainly they are. But I understand the frustration you're feeling if that scenario, however isolated, is true. I want to ask you a question, though. Let's say I've got a company. We're starting a company and we're going to hire 100 people. And we set kind of a hiring exam. And the top 100 scores are all white males. And now it's close, you know, that there are some other scores right below 103, 106, 107, 108 are women, people of color. But the top 100 scores, objectively, are all white males. Should that company hire the top 100 on that exam, even if they're all white males?
Well, no, because then I think the next stage is kind of like a relationship, right? If he has a good job but he's a bad person, I don't want to get involved with him, right? Maybe that's what a girl may discuss with her parents. So it's the same with hiring. I may get in and say they scored fantastic, but the morale is not going to be good with somebody who is very conceited or arrogant or very rude and abrasive in how they broach topics of discussion within the group. And those things always got to come into play as well. So
okay,
personality and the ability to mesh within the business and the dynamic of that environment is critical, and you would factor all of that in.
Okay. So what you're telling me there is that you think that maybe the numbers and the scores on the exam isn't everything. That there may be other
factors. Absolutely not. Absolutely
okay.
not. It's not everything.
Okay, so there may be other factors that are important. Is it also important for companies to have diversity? People of color, people of different backgrounds, different ages, men and women, people of all kinds of different backgrounds. Is there value in that?
Absolutely, but you brought up a good point that, you know, and that's the point here that gets so tricky and complex. That's why this isn't so simple. One way or another, I don't know what the proper word is here, but you're going to, I don't know if it's piss somebody off or upset somebody as they start to feel something change against them. Right. I mean, that's kind of common sense in life. Right. They start taking radio time away from you. You're not going to say, oh, great, I'm so happy for him. Meanwhile, you're losing your identity. So the bottom line here is that as we try to strive for that, we can't ignore the fact of how is this going to negatively impact maybe the males, the white males that didn't see that from struggle from their parents in the past. But now they do sure. because we're way beyond where we were 20, 30, 40 years ago in having that diverse landscape, which, of course, is a very good thing, mm-hmm. but there are other variables and things that are going to come into play as a result. And that's why I think we see a lot of this other stuff with all the racism coming from all sides kind of rearing its head today. And where it's going to go, I don't know, because I don't see an easy solution.
Ron, I want to thank you for the phone call. I'm going to let Chuck follow up as well there. I will say that if I was told tomorrow that someone else is going to get this microphone, that whatever happened and they decided it should be a person of color, that there's enough white males on microphones around the country, I would say it's hard to argue that. And part of my job is to recognize that and to be a host that is at least open to other experience and perspective. And I don't think I would fight it for a second, to be honest with you, but I also understand that my job is not the same as yours. One thing Chuck Collins, I think, maybe gets not excluded, but not talked about as much, when we talk about intersectionality, we talk about advantage, class often doesn't get included as much. And people like Ron are really, you know, frustrated that they feel like they should get this job, and they keep getting lectured on their quote-unquote white privilege, and they don't feel that privilege. What do you think?
No, I think that's a real experience. I think we saw that in the results of this election, that there are a lot of rural, predominantly white communities that feel like they haven't been seen, that they've been left behind. And it's given rise to anger and both progressive populism, sort of a Bernie Sanders, let's look at the concentration of wealth, but also a kind of, I would call it a regressive populism, let's sort of deflect blame onto people of color and new immigrants. And, you know, to me, the driver underneath all of this are the ways in which we're pulling apart and how that's pitting us against each other. And back to the point, I think, you know, what we're learning is companies that have a wide variety of people and perspectives and diversity actually are more efficient and thriving, because we need to bring all these different insights and perspectives. And the only other thing I'd say is just the way privilege works is it accumulates over time. And you know, as somebody who grew up in a white male privileged situation, I can sort of see it very clearly, but I understand that it's not that apparent, particularly if you're in the bottom half of income earners and haven't shared in the opportunities of the last 40 years, really. And that's the moment we're in. We're in a moment where people are understandably feeling betrayed by the economic system, and they're trying to, you know, and sometimes they're blaming other people, and I don't think that's going to move us forward.
This is not for Ron. This is now speaking more generally. There's a great analogy in Chuck's book that I'd like you to share about the bike ride downwind versus the headwind. Well, when we talk about not seeing all of the things that help us along, that we want to tell ourselves that all of our success, 100% of it, is built on our own work. And that's not to say Chuck's book tells you that, you know, none of your success is deserved. Not at all. But you have this analogy about the bike ride, and I'd love for you to share that.
Yeah, you know, I live in the Boston area, and out on Cape Cod, we have this amazing 30-mile bike trail. And one day I was out there riding, and I got up early in the morning, and I decided I was going to go for a 15-mile bike ride. But at the 10-mile mark, I was feeling so good. I was feeling so strong and able. I just kept going, and by the 20-mile marker, I was like, man, am I in good shape, you know, and I kept riding another 5 miles. And then I turned around, took a drink of water, and started my 25-mile ride back to the campground where I was. All of a sudden, this wind picked up, and I'm riding into the wind. And after 2 miles, I'm feeling exhausted and After another mile, I'm thinking, who will come and pick me up, you know, give me a ride home? And as I'm sort of lying there, I'm realizing, oh, that wind had been there all along. On my ride down Cape, I was riding along thinking it was all my locomotion that was moving me forward, when in fact I had this very invisible, subtle wind at my back. And, you know, I was sort of laughing because to me that's the metaphor for privilege. It's not that I wasn't doing anything. I was pedaling, but I had this push. And that is a lot of the way privilege works. So it's not that we're not doing anything. It's not that we're not getting up in the morning and working. And it's that the way privilege and advantage works is it's often very, very subtle. One example of that is one thing I've learned is that having grown up with a lot of privilege and advantage, I have a different sense of agency in the world, meaning I sort of feel this weird entitlement or the ability like, oh, I can fix this, or I can step into the situation, or I can speak up. And it's taken me a while to realize, like, not everybody grew up with those kind of circumstances, and that many people don't feel they have a sense of agency in a situation where things are broken. They don't feel they can speak up. Well, so part of understanding the invisible nature of advantage is to just start to pull those apart. And I think as men, particularly, we have a hard time talking about the help that we get. We don't want to talk about family help. We don't want to talk about government help. I tell a story in the book about meeting with all these World War II veterans who, many of them got the GI Bill and got debt-free or very low-interest mortgages that helped them buy their house, but none of them tell those stories. It's sort of like there's a certain amount of shame whenever you have to admit that you got help and that you didn't just do it all on your own. That part of the way forward is for us to try to tell accurate stories of how advantage works in our lives, and without any shame, or just matter-of-factly, you know, my dad got a VA mortgage, a 1% 40-year fixed-rate mortgage. That's an incredible public subsidy. At the same time, many of African Americans were excluded from those low-interest mortgages and were forced into the predatory mortgage market and contract mortgages. So that's part of just unpacking the history of how advantage works.
Talking to Chuck Collins, the author of the new book, Born on Third Base, a One Percenter Makes the Case for Tackling Inequality, Bringing Wealth Home, and Committing to the Common Good. He is speaking at RIT this afternoon, 4 o'clock to 5 o'clock, followed by a book signing at the Golisano Auditorium at Golisano Hall. And as we work our way through the book here, we'll take more of your phone calls. I'm already panicking looking at the hour going, Chuck, we needed both hours for you today. But let me get our only break of the hour. We'll come back to more of your phone calls. And you're going to hear from Chuck about a number of different things I think are important, not the least of which are, you know, has he met people on the road, one percenters, so to speak, who have listened and said, okay, you know, you're getting through to me. We can kind of form an alliance here. We want to hear some of those stories, and we'll talk about what he thinks are the important next steps towards building a more egalitarian country. That's coming up after the only break on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, we talk to some of the leading experts in a fascinating field. What they're trying to do is use modern technology, combine it a bit with archaeology, and figure out how can we use imaging science to read scrolls that are about 2,000 years old, buried in volcanic ash, carbonized. Can we see inside them to find this lost history? We'll talk about it next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson in Pittsford. This is Hoover on the line with Chuck Collins. Go ahead, Hoover.
Hey, Evan. Good program as always. Before I talk about the Shelby Steele article today, I want the guests to know that I bet you he stays in Maurice's campground out on the Cape, because I've taken that bike trail myself probably a dozen times. And unfortunately for me, the wind is always blowing in my face, no matter which way I'm going.
Well, go ahead, sir.
Well, you know, I should say that's the experience of not having privileges. You just kind of get up and just ride into the wind no matter which way you're trying
there
to go. And that's what life is like for a lot of people.
Yeah. Some days you get up and the wind's blowing in your face until you get home at night. Anyway, there's a great article in today's Wall Street Journal by Shelby Steele, who has written a book called Shame, How America's Past Sins Have Polarized Our Country. But the name of the article is The Exhaustion of American Liberalism. And he talks about there in things about white guilt gave us mock politics based on the pretense of moral authority. Anyone who's listening to this show, take to heart what is being said, but also read this article because it just explains another side of this. And for those of us who do appreciate diversity, we also appreciate diversity of thought. So when I'm in an office, I like to work with people who are some conservative, some liberal, some far left, some Bernie people, you know, and some Trump people. I like to hear ideas from all over because together we're going to get it right. But if we just focusing on one side, we're going to make the same mistakes over and over again. And I think if you read this article by Shelby Steele, it's on page A17. I encourage everyone to read this today. So thanks for taking my call and keep up the good work, Evan.
All right. Thank you, Hoover. I appreciate that. Go ahead, Chuck.
Thanks, Hoover. And I do know Shelby Steele's work, and I think you're right. It's an interesting perspective. And, you know, when I talk about shame, actually, I think one of the things I actually edited an anthology on social class where people were writing from first-person stories, raised poor, raised working class, middle class, and people from my background, you know, sort of owning class or wealthy. And one of the sort of common threads through it all is people have a lot of shame about their class experience. And then, and what that tells me is we have a lot of work to do sort of to peel that back to just understand, you know, why is it that the role of shame keeps us disconnected, keeps us from actually telling accurate stories about our own backgrounds. So I've really actually tried, part of the reasons I wrote this book, Born on Third Base, is just to get out and say, here's what happened to me. Here's what I'm learning about that. I didn't choose the circumstances of my birth. And I'm trying to break through, you know, and I have to admit, I probably did feel a certain amount of shame the first 30 years of my life because even though I was born on third base, I still was like kind of embarrassed that I'm standing there on third base at the place where everyone else is working very hard to get to. So I think there's, you know, sometimes shame gets a bad rap, like, oh, we're publicly shaming people because they're white or whatever. I just think it's an invitation to take a look, a deeper look at our experience.
John in Brighton called in to say that Chuck's interview on Bill Moyer's show with Bill Gates Sr. was great and worth a listen. So that comes from John in Brighton. If anybody wants to look that up, it's back when you wrote a book with Bill Gates Sr. 10, 12 years ago now. Time flies, doesn't it?
Yeah.
talked about the estate tax. And so let's talk a little bit about some of the stories. You've been on the road with Bill Gates Sr. You've given presentations around the country. You've talked to people who are quote-unquote one percenters who hear you appeal to them to be willing to be taxed more, to be willing to contribute more. And sometimes they say you're crazy, but sometimes they say, thanks for not demonizing me, and they give you a little story. Give me a sense for some of what you've experienced.
Well, I would say, first of all, you know, there is a segment of the 1% that uses its wealth and power to rig the rules of the economy to get more wealth and power. But that's actually, in my experience, a very fairly small segment of people. And then there's a lot of people on the other side who are very often behind the scenes, investing, giving philanthropically, paying their taxes without complaining, supporting a progressive tax system. And there's networks like the Patriotic Millionaires, Responsible Wealth, the Resource Generation Network, young people under 35. They're basically figuring out how to use their privilege to create a more fair economy. And I meet people all the time. And Bill Gates' dad was a great spokesperson on this. And people, thousands of people came out to hear and were in agreement. And actually, the polling shows that within the 1%, people believe they should pay more taxes, actually, that they want to live in a more equitable society. One of the interesting things about people in the wealthiest groups is they actually travel more, see other societies that have less inequality, they go to, you know, on vacation to France, and they see what it looks like to have a society that has a beautiful public sphere, where public tax dollars, you know, create gardens and infrastructure. So they have a perspective that is, oh, the United States could be more that way. We could have less extreme inequality, and that would actually be better for everybody. So the 1% is not at all monolithic in that way. It's understandable that people feel angry because, you know, the way the society has become polarized economically and racially. But I think my message to everybody else is there are some potential allies there, and they are working behind the scenes often to build a more equitable society.
And you've met many of the allies on the road. You also have two different sections on the book, one called Pay Your Taxes, the other called Pay Your Damn Taxes. So I know that there is a message to the 1% as well. And one of the ways that the wealthiest Americans pay a lower share of their income in taxes or their money in taxes is they give charitably. And often you hear people say, but I'm giving to charitable causes. I have a foundation. I'm doing all this. To me, one of the most enlightening parts of this book, Born on Third Base, was about charity and how it, in your view, should not be a substitute for simply paying your taxes. Why?
Well, partly because charity isn't going to be up to the task. I mean, if you think about, you know, all the money that's given to charity last year from individuals, it's like $330 billion. A food stamps program is $75 billion. The public infrastructure to that, well, here's how I think about it. After World War II, 1945 to 1975, we taxed ourselves. We taxed high incomes and wealth much more progressively and invested it in public goods like debt-free education, like infrastructure, opportunities for people to go to college without, you know, mountains of debt, and that those were good investments. And charity is not going to be a substitute for that. So in some ways, charity is important, and I love the fact that we have a vibrant independent sector, that we have independent radio stations and universities that are supported by that independent, you know, that charitable sector. But we are disinvesting sort of the public opportunity ladder, if you will. We're not investing in the kind of early childhood education and all the things that actually would really reduce these inequalities. So I sometimes worry that the discussion about charity is almost sort of a distraction from the real work, and it's certainly not a substitute for an adequately funded, robust public sector. And I'm talking not just national, but state and local government and the role that we play in ensuring, you know, a good platform for a good life. And there's a lot of charitable money that unfortunately kind of is compounding the inequalities right now, worsening them.
This is an important point. How do you think sometimes charitable giving compounds inequality?
Well, one example is, there are wealthy school districts where they create public school foundations where people give to support public schools in these wealthy districts. It's not something that urban school districts can do. So this is people taking a charitable deduction, thereby reducing their tax obligations and giving money to, compound the advantages in their own district. So that's just one example. But there's a lot of examples where, unfortunately, charity doesn't really get at the root causes of problems. And huge amounts of charity go toward things that actually aren't addressing poverty, structural inequality, and the environmental crisis we're dealing with. Only 30% or so is really doing that.
And this is the section of the book that had me thinking about Malcolm Gladwell taking a brickbat to people like Phil Knight, founder of Nike, who's given $400 million to Stanford, you know, which already has a $20 billion endowment. And there are public schools, colleges, universities that are trying to educate more people, trying to have more of an opportunity. And yet we are giving hundreds of millions of dollars to Harvard and Princeton and Stanford and even Oregon and the like, which already have huge endowments and are comparatively in a very different situation. I thought about what Chuck is saying here, because if you're giving money even to public school systems and there are foundations for them, think about how much public school systems, the wealthiest, are already spending per pupil. Think about urban districts that don't have the same property tax base. And we can talk about whether the property tax system probably should be changed. But that's a case where the wealthiest are going to get wealthier. And it's technically charity, and the people who give the money to that charity then get to write it off on their taxes, which means people like you and me get to cover more or at least pay a higher percentage into the tax base. We're kind of subsidizing them, aren't we?
We are. I mean, if for every dollar that a billionaire gives to charity, you and I are chipping in 40 to 50 cents in lost tax revenue. Well, that's why it's our business. You know, some people say, well, charity, it's my money. I can do what I want. That's fine, but if you're taking a tax break, you're reducing your taxes, you're not giving to build public infrastructure and support public schools, you're giving to the things that you want to give it to. And it's another form of private power. I co-edit a website called inequality.org, and we just did a study called Gilded Giving, Top Heavy Philanthropy in an Age of Extreme Inequality. And one of the most troubling trends is actually giving by low and middle income givers has steadily been going down over 20 years. And most of the growth in philanthropy is by mega gifts, the people who give $50 million, $100 million, the Phil Knight gift or whatever. And if you play that out, this is where we're going. We're moving toward an era of big philanthropy where every billionaire is going to have their own foundation. And some of that money will go to good things, no doubt. But some of it will just become an extension of private power. And the wealthy are opting out of paying their fair share of taxes in a way that the rest of us don't, because we don't create charitable foundations. So that's a problem.
All right, Jane in Rochester next on the phone. Go ahead, Jane.
Yes. I'll just tell a short story about my ex-husband, who was a veteran. He not only got his education paid for, but when he went to work as a professional, he was hired immediately. And his qualifications, he had not even finished a bachelor's at that time. And I had girlfriends in that same area and in that same office eventually who could not get hired. So we're talking about white male privilege. The Vietnam War, especially, the soldiers were primarily, well, I won't say primarily white, but the ones that took advantage or were able to take advantage of education and apply for professional jobs, especially they were white males. And that is really a boost up. So when you did get into that career field, you were supervised by a white male. And they had a lot to influence in the structure of work and the attitudes and so forth. It became more patriarchal because of that influx of so many males, especially in the South where I lived. And just one more short anecdote. When I've worked about 30 years, if you include volunteer work, and I don't care where I work, government, private, volunteer, even in politics, the guys had the advantage. They were listened to more. But in this particular office, we had four women. Three of us had some college. I had a master's, another had a BA, another had business school. And we had been there for years working, and they came in one day and said, well, we're hiring a guy. And they were talking to the manager, and I overheard it. And they said, we need you to train him because he's not experienced in the work we do, and he will be supervising all of you. And so the manager protested. All of us were female now. And she said, well, what qualifies him more than any of us? Well, he has 2 years of college. And she says, we all do. And except for one person, three of the four of us did. But they never hired anybody. But that would have been, I don't know what he would have gone through, but it couldn't have been too bad to suit any of us. But they just overlooked us. Experienced, had worked in the office, they knew us, and went over our heads to get this white male who was younger. He was under 30. All of us were over 30. And so tell me how that came about. If we weren't competent, we should have been fired. But you can't do that to women. We don't forget it. And, of course, men have always gotten help because women frequently step back professionally and take care of the home and the children while he develops his profession. So we're behind because of that. But he gets that gift of being able to focus almost solely on his profession.
Well, Jane, you got to let me jump in here. You're on a tear.
I'm on a tear, but it's very demoralizing and very discouraging, and we really resent people coming in who are less qualified than we are, and all he has going for him is that he's a white male, and I've just seen that too much. I know I'm not alone, and so if men are experiencing some of this now, they realize just how it feels, and maybe they need that comeuppance. Thank you.
Jane, thanks for the phone call. Very different than Ron's perspective, no doubt about that. Chuck, what do you think?
Well, I just think Jane's example is an unfortunate example of how we missed out on the talents. This is an example of you have these resourceful and talented women who have been sort of pushed aside. And from a structural level, you know, we did after World War II, 1945 to 1975, and particularly in the South, we put millions of white male Americans on the wealth-building train with the GI Bill, debt-free education, with low-interest mortgages for first-time homebuyers. And that was a huge public investment, and it propelled a lot of people, and a lot of people were left behind. A lot of people of color were left behind, and a lot of women were left behind. So, you know, I guess I come back to saying we can do that. What a good society does is it invests in its people, providing education opportunity for everybody, and we're still living with that legacy of that sort of unequal advantage coming out of those years.
Well, speaking of advantage, John in Rochester thinks we talk too much about privilege. Go ahead, John.
Hey, Evan. Hey, Chuck.
Hey, John.
You know, I got to say, I'm listening to this, and I just think this privilege concept is way overblown. And I'll tell you one reason why. Number one, I grew up in a low-income family, and we never thought anything about the privileged people supposedly over and above us. And we worked hard and appreciated what we have. The danger I see in putting forth this privilege concept all the time is people are going to start thinking that, let's say the underprivileged, are going to start thinking that life owes us a living. And that's the thing that bothers me, Chuck. What are your thoughts?
Okay. Thank you, John. Chuck Collins, what do you think?
You know, my experience is that privilege, understanding how advantage works. I understand a lot of people feel a little prickly and defensive when they hear that word privilege because they feel like, look, I don't have any privilege. I'm working hard. But my experience is most people actually don't fess up to the ways in which they have advantages. And it's a useful thing to understand just how inequality works, how it isn't just about individual effort. My experience is there's a lot of people actually who were in my circumstances, sort of born on third base, who still retell their own story as if it's still all about them, that they were able to kind of get where they are primarily because of their own efforts. Donald Trump and George Bush and, you know, Ted Kennedy, who was my U.S. senator. Now, what I liked about Ted Kennedy is he said, you know, I made my wealth the old-fashioned way. I inherited it. You know, he would sort of admit that he had this family advantage. But what happens when people don't sort of talk about the advantages they have is they sort of perpetuate the myth that it's actually everybody has the same opportunity. It's a level playing field. Anybody can get to where I am. And that's the dangerous myth, because that's not true. And as Jane, the previous caller, said, you know, here's somebody, she worked as hard and got the same level of education, but she was barred from being able to move forward. So I think it is a useful thing. Privilege sometimes is a little loaded, but I think we should all do a little bit of an inventory. What are, to the extent we have advantages, what are they? Where did they come from? And not just look at our own lives, but look multi-generationally. You know, we need to have a conversation in this country about the legacy of slavery and Jim Crow and how that has created compounding disadvantages for African Americans and from First Nations people. If we don't really fess up to that and just think, oh, everybody's at the same level playing field, everybody's got the same starting gate, we're going to miss out. We're going to miss out on people like Jane and others.
There was another analogy, and then I want to get to another listener comment. We're losing the hour, but there was a great analogy. I think it was the poker analogy. Imagine you're playing a poker game where people are basically, you know, stealing the chips or taking all the chips. And then all of a sudden, somebody says, wait, stop the game. Let's start fresh. From here on out, nobody gets an advantage. But all of a sudden, you're looking around the table, and there's a few people with huge chip stacks, and you've got just a few. And you're going, from here on out, though, it's even. And you're going, wait a second, I'm a little bit of a disadvantage here.
Yeah, Evan, how come you have that giant pile of chips in front of you and I don't?
Yeah, that's a great point.
Because, what are we going to do about
Because, as Chuck points out in the book, a lot of people say, well, those problems that we're talking about, that was previous generations. I wasn't a part of redlining. I wasn't a part of that. Why am I getting penalized? Because right now, the table is set up for that disadvantage to continue into future generations, even if we didn't create the game. And I thought that was a very interesting analogy. So,
I mean, one thing I would acknowledge is we come back to, there are a lot of people who have not shared in the prosperity of the last 40 years who are maybe listening to this program saying, I don't have any advantage or privilege. In fact, I'm just trying to survive. And that's the reality. So even if you're like a white person and you're just trying to survive, I understand how it sounds to hear somebody like me talking about privilege. It just sounds like, you know, you're out of your mind. But we have, the way privilege works is it works over generations. So when I say I have four generations of advantage, that's huge, the sort of stability. And there's an inverse to that, which is other people had four generations of economic instability. You know, when my uncle got the GI Bill and the low interest mortgage, my friend Diedrich's uncle, who's African-American, was excluded from that, didn't get on the wealth building train, got into a predatory loan situation, didn't build any equity or wealth, and is unable to help his children and grandchildren. That's the corollary. So there's sort of behind each story of I made it myself, there's also these sort of supports that I think we have to account for.
Well, here's an email. I don't know if it's written to me or to Chuck, but I'll read it in full. Terry writes to us and says, "You are an idiot. I pay a ton in taxes. Don't even try to convince me I should pay more. The estate tax is immoral." All right, Chuck, you wrote a whole book on the estate tax. Immoral.
Well, you know, one of the things about the estate tax is people have strong feelings about it. But let's just start with the basics. Today, you will not pay an what I call the inheritance tax. You won't pay an estate tax unless you have more than $5.4 million as an individual or almost $11 million as a couple. So it's only paid by people in the top 0.1%, the very, very wealthy. If you have that level of wealth, you, the estate tax, by the way, mostly taxes accumulated wealth that has never been taxed. It's appreciated property and stocks, and it's not like an income tax. It's not like an annual tax. It is a tax on inheritances. If we want to put a brake on the concentrations of wealth and power, having an estate tax is a good thing. So it's not immoral. It's what a good society does to keep us from pulling apart and distorting. So, you know, the person who wrote the email, congratulations if you have that level of wealth. That's, you probably do pay a lot of income taxes. But the reality is, if you have over $11 million, you didn't do it alone. You didn't do it, you know, the society, the public investments, the infrastructure that we build together is a key ingredient in your good fortune. And the way we continue to sustain that for future generations is we have an inheritance tax.
Was it Bill Gates Sr. in the book? You tell the story of how he said to a room full of people, imagine all the good ideas, the innovation that you brought to your business that led to your success. But how many of you, if you had to choose the United States or pick a country that's known as quote-unquote a third world country, and had, would you want to be in the United States with that opportunity, or would you want to be there? Part of the estate tax is because you are in this society that gives you the chance to do this in the first place. And what would that be worth it to you? How much would you pay for that opportunity versus somewhere else? I thought that was a very interesting way to describe it too.
Yeah. If you don't want to pay the estate tax, go to a country that doesn't have this kind of amazing commonwealth of public investments in education and infrastructure and wealth creation and wealth protections. See how wealthy you're going to become there. You're not going to want to be there. You're going to want to be here. And the price of citizenship is to pay your taxes. And if the price of having tens of millions of dollars is you pay an inheritance tax so that some other folks out there who are not born wealthy can have the same opportunities you had.
Yeah, and I'll say as we run out of time here with Chuck, his own personal story, giving away his $500,000 family inheritance at the age of 26, and the way he writes about the estate tax and responsibility and what happens to kids of privilege, it at least makes us think about whether leaving children a bunch of money is actually good or bad for them. It's a very interesting question. The book is called Born on Third Base, A One Percenter Makes the Case for Tackling Inequality, Bringing Wealth Home, and Committing to the Common Good by Chuck Collins. He's here today because he's at RIT. So if you were on the phone and couldn't get through, go see Chuck in person 4 to 5 o'clock this afternoon at Golisano Auditorium at Golisano Hall. He loves tangling with people from all different backgrounds. It's what he does all the time on the road. I hope you have a good time there. And I just wish we had 2 hours with you.
Thanks, Evan, for a great conversation.
Well, we appreciate that. Yeah. And again, the website that you edit online?
Inequality.org. That's how you can find me.
Inequality.org. It's a very interesting book. Short break. More Connections is next.